Good afternoon and welcome to KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis. My name is Dr. Andy Jones, and this is Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. I appreciate you tuning into your local campus and community radio station this afternoon. I'm very excited to introduce you all in just a couple minutes to Robert Jordan. Robert Jordan is a Forbes 500 CEO. He founded Online Access, the first internet coverage magazine in the world. After the sale of Online Access, he launched two companies, Red Flash, which is an interim management team, and interim CEO, interim CFO, a worldwide network for interim contract and project executives. He's got a brand new book out. It's called How They Did It, Billion Dollar Insights from the Heart of America. And it will help all of you who are thinking, what am I going to do with my own creative discoveries, ideas, widgets of one sort or another? How am I going to present them to the largest possible audience? Bob Jordan is going to talk to us today, talk to all of the entrepreneurs listening at home and possible entrepreneurs about some of the ideas that he learned from all of the billionaires, CEOs, who he's been interviewing and that he talks about and talks with and quotes in his new book, How They Did It, Billion Dollar Insights from the Heart of America. And then in the second half of the program, we will be sharing with you some read and recorded poetry. It's just about time for graduation in another week, and so I'll have some inspiring thoughts from great poets. That, jazz bumper music, public service announcements, and an occasional insight from me. My name is Dr. Andy, and this is Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Welcome back, everyone, to KDVS. Regular listeners of this radio show know that over the last 10 years, we've been celebrating creativity, great writing, poetry, innovative uses of technology in all sorts. And we've been focusing in the last, perhaps year and a half, especially because of my stint teaching at our graduate business school here at UC Davis, our graduate school of management. We've been focusing especially about entrepreneurs. How is it that creative people can turn their ideas into presentations of products or new workflows, new business prospects that will mean a great deal to the lives of a great number of people? Well, I'd say that Robert Jordan is uniquely qualified to speak on this topic. He has interviewed 45 millionaires and billionaires and featured these entrepreneurs and their valuable nuggets of business advice in his new book, How They Did It, Billion Dollar Insights from the Heart of America. Robert Jordan received his bachelor's degree from the Honors College at the University of Michigan and his MBA from the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University. I'm very pleased to have him on the live line. Bob Jordan, welcome to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour.
Thank you so much, Dr. Andy.
It's great to have you here. And I'm fascinated by this book that I have in my hands, in part because one of the joys of doing this radio show over this last decade has been my opportunity to interview, chat with, and learn something from a great number of creative professionals. And you've done something similar, though with a focus on how is it that people have achieved astounding success, usually in the business world.
Yes. I was just fascinated by the whole idea. How does somebody start out from scratch? And, you know, if the average result is, you know, a small business, and there's nothing wrong with that, but how does somebody start from zero and get to $1 billion in sales? How do you do that? That's what fascinated me.
Well, and the book itself is fascinating. It's a hardcover book. It's longer than it is tall. And this gives you a chance to present different insights of different millionaires and billionaires, as well as other people who are worth quoting. Long form, sometimes in their own handwriting, really personalizing this idea of success and entrepreneurism.
Yeah, it was part of what we did, that we wanted these champions to write in their own handwriting. And originally this was just a book of quotes. It was meant to be an inspiration for, well, really the next generation of entrepreneurs. So that was the whole goal. It turned into something a little bigger because the stories that I heard from these people were so fascinating that we had to do more. So as you see from the format, there is this detailed Q&A running through the book that makes it a much more dense experience.
Absolutely. Well, I'm always interested when people with varied experiences decide to take on a book project. You spoke before about how this began as with a focus on quotations and quotations only. How is it that you knew that you wanted to grow this into the book that it is now, how they did it?
Well, because of the fact that, you know, here I got exposed to all of these entrepreneurs, they were really the ones who pushed me forward with the idea. The initial start of this is that we defined a group. We said, let's go talk to people who started from scratch, launched, grew a company, and sold it for $100 million or more, or went public for $300 million or more. And what we then wanted to do was to assemble this group, technology companies in the heartland, and have them all in one place. We invited them to a lunch, and my pitch to them was, I said, we're going to multi-author this book in 90 minutes. And it sounds impossible. It turned out it was impossible, but it did get a bunch of billionaires in one room, and that's how the project started.
Oh, that must be fun. Well, tell me a few examples of the billionaires who you interacted with, who not only impressed you, but who made an impression upon you emotionally and intellectually, as well as with the size of their portfolios.
There were stories like Rock Mackey. He's a professor at University of Wisconsin. He and his graduate students came up with a better idea for MRI technology, and it turned into a company called Tomotherapy. The thing I found inspiring about Rock was that at the point when he was going to launch the company, there was a big partner, GE, and GE backed out of the whole project. And so Rock had to fire the entire staff. But from that point, I mean, of utter defeat, he came back and slowly but surely rebuilt the whole business, ended up going public at about $1 billion valuation. The company was public for a few years, and it just merged with another company. But that story, I thought, was incredibly inspiring.
That's great. And I know that one of the themes that you bring up in the book is the fact that we can learn a great deal from failure, how failure is often necessary, that it shouldn't be stigmatized, but that we need to fail in particularly wise ways. I'm wondering if you could say something about that.
Well, you know, Andy, the funny thing about this is that I thought, because we self-selected an audience of people who are incredibly successful,
right,
that, you know, they might not have necessarily had any problems. The reality for the group is that they tended to hit many more challenges. They had a lot more strikeouts than the average person in business, and I thought that was incredible. And it turns out that they view their failures in a completely different way. They look at it much more like their experiments that didn't work, as opposed to, you know, sometimes thinking, oh, that didn't work, I'm a bad person, I better go home now.
Right. And so I guess that had something to do with perseverance. But when you say experiment, it also suggests a kind of healthy detachment from the emotional ups and downs of failure and success.
You're absolutely right. I'll tell you what afterwards I kind of decided, because after doing hundreds of hours of these interviews, I kind of realized that I hadn't spotted any cynicism. And, you know, we kind of live in a cynical world. And instead, what there was so much of was curiosity.
Right.
And this group was just so curious about things going on right around them. And the companies that these people started, even hitting billion-dollar valuations, they were not, cures for new diseases. They didn't have to go off to the top of a mountain to figure it out. Most of them didn't have to have advanced degrees. It was the curiosity about the problems they saw right around them, and that's how they started to think about products and solutions to bring out. And all of them started very modestly.
If you're just joining us, Robert Jordan is my guest. He's the author of a brand new book called How They Did It, Billion Dollar Insights from the Heart of America. I hear that you started with that kind of $100 million benchmark to see if someone would qualify to appear in the book. But interestingly, from what you just said, it sounds like that a lot of these intellectual and creative heroes, they cared less about the money than perhaps other folks who would try to assess who they are from afar. But other things drove them, such as what you were just saying about curiosity.
Yes, and you're reminding me of some of the quotes in the book. One of the founders, Don Maurer, he said, true entrepreneurship is not money-driven. He's in the medical technology arena, and he was completely driven by this desire to help people. He was dealing with individuals with limited motion, where he was coming up with inventions, physical, inventions for them. And most of the entrepreneurs in the book were like that. You could tell that clearly money was not the primary motivator that had them get going.
Well, probably one could say the same thing about you, Bob Jordan. You've certainly been successful in life. You probably didn't need to write this book to make money from it. So I'm wondering about your own motivations beyond what you've already said. And if the creative output, when you have this handsome-looking book in your hands, how would you characterize the extent to which it was worth all the efforts?
It took 4 years to do the book, and I had to explain to family and employees and friends that it was a labor of love, and then everyone kind of writes it off and says, okay, do whatever you want to do. You know, it's just clearly the thing that you are passionate about, Andy, is what you have to do. So, for example, you're passionate about your show.
Right.
And that is true here. I think the one thing I learned from the founders that was different is that they first spotted a need, some need in the world, and they became passionate about that. And so it wasn't a blind kind of passion. It was something very specific, that they saw something they could do better, some problem they could solve, and that's what fueled a burning desire. Interestingly, the last thing on the list is skill. I think a lot of people think, well, I don't have the skills to do this. And the lesson here is none of these people had the skills at the starting off point that they eventually needed, and you can always hire those skills if you don't develop them yourself.
Well, that's certainly an excellent lesson to learn, and connects to what you were saying before about many of these founders didn't have advanced degrees. It sounds like they were learning the equivalent of graduate degree lessons and sometimes skills as they went about founding these companies, no matter how long it took.
Right. If you heard how modest some of these starts were and where they ended up, it's incredible. I'm remembering the story of Vince Pettinelli, and he's a psychologist by training, and he was in state government in Ohio, and he quit a very secure job. He had a wife and a young baby, and quit a secure job to start a single home, a home for 10 severely retarded individuals. Now, if that doesn't sound like a recipe to not get rich, right?
Right.
And yet when he ended up, he created a company called PeopleServe. He was in 20 states. He had 7,800 residents, 9,000 employees. He sold the company for $200 million. But these modest circumstances of starting, clearly they're not an impediment to taking an idea and making it big.
That's great. Well, if you're just joining us, Robert Jordan is my guest. He's the author of a new book called How They Did It, Billion Dollar Insights from the Heart of America. Robert, we're going to take a quick break for a public service announcement, and then when we return, I've got a few more questions for you.
Great.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis. My name is Dr. Andy Jones, and this is Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour.
The Linux Users Group of Davis, or LUGOD, is a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting the Linux computer operating system and other open source products as an alternative to expensive, proprietary, and monopolistic software. LUGOD meets in Davis on the first Tuesday and third Monday of each month. For more information, visit LUGOD's website at lugod.org or contact Bill Kendrick at 530-759-1019. Or via email at root@lugod.org.
A lot of people claim they are.
Welcome back to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour on KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis. In the second half of the show, we will enjoy some read and recorded poetry. But right now, we're chatting with Robert Jordan. He's the author of a new book called How They Did It, Billion Dollar Insights from the Heart of America. We were talking before about the need to differentiate your own project from what people think you should be doing. And I came across a great quotation in this book by Rich, is it Heise?
Heise.
Rich Heise says, until a business is self-funding, it's just a really expensive hobby. Your first goal as an entrepreneur is always, no matter what, to get your business to break even. And I was thinking about that with the great number of poets who we have come on this show, and many of them are authors of books of poetry, but those are not usually money-making ventures of one sort or another. And as a result, poets have often thought, well, how is it that I continue to do what I do, and that is to write poetry, talk about poetry, sometimes teach poetry, but also keep ahead of the bill collectors? And so a lot of them have started their own businesses, sometimes using their communication skills or web design skills or whatever the case may be. And one of them said to me on a show not too long ago, I realized that I couldn't keep deducting the costs that were associated with my poetry writing work, because the government says that if you've got a business that doesn't make money for 3 years, that it's classified as a hobby, and therefore it's no longer a tax-deductible enterprise. So I thought that was interesting with regard to what Rich Heise said in terms of your number one goal, and that is to get in the black.
It's true. The only thing I thought when Rich said that to me is that in the technology world, you have examples of companies, you know, the AOL launched the first instant messenger service, and they did it by buying an Israeli company called ICQ. And that company, ICQ, was proud of the fact that they had not made $1 of revenue before AOL bought them for $420 million. So I agree with what Rich said. I just see these examples sometimes where I guess the founders sometimes think, well, maybe it's the next guy. Maybe we've done a technology that, you know, a bigger company will like.
Right.
It's taking a risk. I mean, it pays off sometimes. I think most of the time Rich is right.
Someone else who is a risk taker in your book, you interviewed mostly men in the book, but Bonnie Baskin is in here. And she says something really important about a theme that you brought up before, and that is determination. And the need, as she says, to really be successful, you have to be able to continually see that the glass is half full and not ever, ever give up. Because there are so many people who are defeated by the obstacles, problems, or mishaps that they encounter.
Yeah, this points to the mindset of entrepreneurship, which is there are going to be problems, they're going to keep coming up, and you have to stay in the game. And it's a little bit, I think now, like, you know, Thomas Edison inventing the light bulb. However many times he tried, I don't know what it was, 3,000, 5,000, 10,000.
Right.
But none of us would have believed it if at the 3,000th experiment he would have said, I'm a bad person, it didn't work, I guess I better go home. I mean, the context of it is we all hear that and we just know he's going to do 3,001 because that's what he's supposed to do. And that's how successful entrepreneurs look at this, which is that everything they do is essentially an experiment, and when they don't work, you move on and try a new experiment in everything, product design, marketing, finance, the works.
And from my point of view as a writer, I'd say that this is also true for writing projects. That
absolutely true.
Inevitably, first drafts will be crappy, if you can say that on the radio, and you have to forgive yourself and keep writing and just acknowledge that nothing will be perfect the first time out, and that you just have to keep revising and revising, or writing and writing, inventing and inventing, and that sooner or later, if only it's because you'll have the, 10,000 hours that we're supposed to have, according to Malcolm Gladwell in his book, The Outliers, once we have those 10,000 hours behind us, that we will become an expert in our passion, and then those successes will have fewer failures between them. But either way, you've got to keep at it.
Exactly true. And you're reminding me, Andy, of another example. Dick Costolo was interviewed in the book. He is now the CEO of Twitter. Before that, he was a very successful entrepreneur who'd sold a number of companies. And he said the process at his companies was like going to see the eye doctor. He said it was a little bit like, you know, when they put those lenses up to your eyes and they say, okay, is A better than B? Or is B better than C? And he said that's the way they looked at everything they did, product design, marketing, and everything else. They just continually kept looking at it, and what's better? What's working better than this? That was their recipe.
Excellent. So what is your hope, your objective for this sort of book? It's just come out, and I'll remind folks that Robert Jordan's book is How They Did It, Billion Dollar Insights from the Heart of America. And Seth Godin, who's another thought leader in entrepreneurism and a great number of other things, says there is hard-fought, useful wisdom on every single page. Everyone, what a find. What have been your goals for this particular book, in addition to sharing all the creativity of these entrepreneurs?
Well, I wrote the book to help aspiring entrepreneurs get past the inevitable wall which stops so many of us. And we've even developed a seminar to help them overcome the hurdles so that they can triumph. Unfortunately, we don't have one of the seminars by you in California, but if any listeners do happen to get to New York or Washington or Chicago this fall, we have a series of events where founders in the book are going to be on a panel and tell their stories in person and talk to aspiring entrepreneurs, you know, essentially one-on-one.
Oh, that's a lot of fun. Well, that suggests, too, that here are some fabulously rich people who themselves are interested in mentoring others, helping others, conversing with others, suggesting that they're not spending all their time, you know, on their yachts or on the golf course.
No, this really is the common theme here is that they all became convinced that this was part of their legacy, that to go pass on some inspiration and advice to the next generation of entrepreneurs. That's why they did this. That's why they agreed to be in the book.
Excellent. I spoke at the very start about creativity. And, of course, creativity is built into, say, finding a niche that no one had seen before and thinking about how that niche could be filled with a product or a service. But I'm wondering to what extent you saw creativity coming up as a theme, a repeated point with all the CEOs and founders that you interviewed for How They Did It.
Andy, it's a really interesting point. It's a recurring theme. You know, as you're talking, you're reminding me of some of the stories Jim Dolan told me. He has a public company called Dolan Company. He said when he was a kid, he bought some firecrackers in the summer, and he, for some reason, decided to hang on to them. And in the middle of the winter, Christmas or New Year's, he brought some out, and he had bought them for 25 cents. And he brought some out, and a kid, a friend of his, said, "I'll give you a dollar for a firecracker." And Jim told me, he said, a light bulb went on. And he realized there was a way to make money here.
Right.
And it kind of created this, the entrepreneur within. And I just thought that was such a wonderful kind of creative moment. I think we all have those moments. We have those flashes of inspiration that something is going on here. And I'm sure you can relate to that in terms of your writing.
Absolutely. Well, that's wonderful. And I was really interested in the writing that you did for this book. And of course, a lot of it is listening too, knowing what questions to ask, because you've got some really creative and eloquent people in this book, and it was a delightful opportunity for me to read through it and to see what some of these entrepreneurial heroes had to say.
Well, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Well, let's remind folks, the book is How They Did It, Billion Dollar Insights from the Heart of America. And the author is Robert Jordan. Robert, before I let you go, why don't you tell us a little bit more about you? Where do you live, and what are your next steps or goals? Is it another book? Is it a new business? What, in addition to the seminars that you spoke about before?
I live outside Chicago, and we are putting a lot of energy into the book. It's interesting, as a first-time author, I naively thought you finished the book and you're done.
Right.
And that's not the case. It actually is the starting point. And so we now put a lot of time into, as we'd say, carrying on the conversation on the website, because there are just many people that want to start businesses and are looking for inspiration. And so we continue to do interviews. I'm not sure at this point what kind of second book it turns into, but we've also started to do video interviews with founders, and it really is just this whole desire to inspire that next generation.
That's great. You spoke of the website. To what extent have you used social media as well to either hear stories from people or to share some of the stories that you just spoke of?
Well, I've certainly had my lessons in marketing on Facebook. We now have thousands of fans on a Facebook page, and it's wonderful for having kind of an instant conversation that you can't have any other way. And we are found, of course, because there's a lot of information on the website. So in terms of search engine optimization, folks show up at the website, which is howtheydidit.com. So we keep on learning that way.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, and it's a good reminder, too, that technology is either a pre-step or a step that comes after some sort of flash of genius or new invention, and that often we're using these communication technologies to get the word out, to encourage communication, and then eventually, as you're discovering with this possible second new book, collaboration as well.
Yes, and I would imagine for a lot of the authors you have on, Andy, and a lot of the poets as well, that the Internet, and specifically I'm referring to blogging, is a good first step. And I think a lot of authors in the future, before they produce a book, are going to engage an audience online through a blog, and that's going to inform, making a better product in the end.
And as a writing teacher who teaches a bunch of writing classes at UC Davis, as well as for the English department and our technicultural studies program, I can often tell when a student has been a blogger for a year or more. No matter what sort of goofy or picayune projects or topics my students end up writing about, once they have that experience of writing for an audience, no matter how small, they come into my writing classrooms with a lot more confidence and focus, and they're a delight to teach.
That's very interesting. And so they get that practical experience just from having a little bit of a broadcast themselves.
Well, absolutely. And part of it is that they learn about discipline. They learn about deadlines, even if they're self-imposed. And they realize, too, that instead of writing writerly prose, where they're just focusing on their own emotions and immediate responses, they're gradually writing more and more readerly prose, where they know that they have to connect with an audience that has a short attention span and sometimes needs to read evidence of a sense of humor or a purpose or a thesis. And then what happens is they have that practice, whether they think of it as practice or not, for my writing classes. And then they come to learn from me, work with me, and I can use them as examples to share with their peers. So I think it's a very important step, and I think you're right to emphasize blogging as an important entree to deeper and clearer thinking for entrepreneurs, students, poets, all sorts of people.
And there are now some good success stories out there of bloggers who've gotten real-life book contracts.
Absolutely. And as you point out, success stories of people who are wildly successful in other fields who have turned to blogging to get their messages out. So it's an important confluence of all these different kinds of creativity and innovation. It's a lot of fun to host this radio show because of it, because I get a lot of those people on my live line or here in the studios of KDBS. Well, Robert Jordan, it's been a huge pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for your time this afternoon, and continued good luck to you with your new book, How They Did It, Billion Dollar Insights from the Heart of America.
Thanks so much, Dr. Andy.
Good to talk to you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, you are listening to KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis. My name is Dr. Andy Jones, and we'll be back with more of Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Everyone, to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Are you enjoying this groovy music? Future Sounds of Jazz is what we're listening to. This is the third track called Leave Me Now from a jazz group called Stateless, featuring, I think, that singer that you hear. Her name is Bless, B-L-E-S-S, the Future Sounds of Jazz, here on KDBS 90.3 FM in Davis. You know what we haven't done for a while is played some recorded poetry. This afternoon on the radio show, we're going to hear some of the sounds the voice of Langston Hughes. This is a Smithsonian Folk Wave CD that I have in my hand with a number of recordings of Langston Hughes, who passed away in 1967, reading his poetry, one of his most famous poems. And I think one of the first poems he ever wrote is called The Negro Speaks of Rivers. I think that we get to hear Mr. Hughes talk about the genesis of this poem. So let's take a listen. This is KDBS 90.3 FM in Davis. My name is Dr. Andy, and here on Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour, the voice of Langston Hughes.
I've known rivers ancient of the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo, and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I, too, sing America. I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but I laugh and eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow, I'll be at the table when company comes. Nobody'll dare say to me, "Eat in the kitchen," then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful we are and be ashamed. I, too, am America.
This is Dr. Andy of Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. A number of years ago, maybe it was about 16 years ago now, 17, Spalding Gray came to UC Davis. Not all of you know who Spalding Gray is. He was a novelist, he was an actor, but he was most famous for his monologues. I saw him first in the early 80s, maybe it was... mid-80s, 1986, I saw his movie, Swimming to Cambodia. I was fascinated by what a great storyteller he was. When he spoke over at Celeste Turner Wright Hall in the main theater here on campus, talking a little bit about poetry, he said that he had recently listened to an entire album of the poetry of Robert Lowell, but that he loved the stories that preceded and followed the poetry more than the poems themselves. I guess that shouldn't be surprising from someone who was such a devoted aficionado of the narrative form. Well, I have in my hand a CD called First Words. It's a collection of the beginnings of different books read by the authors of those books. So I thought we'd hear from one of Spalding Gray's books, the beginning, called Monster in a Box. I believe that this is safe for radio from having heard it a great number of years ago, but I will have my finger on the dump button just in case. Ladies and gentlemen, Spalding Gray, the late Spalding Gray now, with an excerpt from Monster in a Box.
Monster in a Box is my 13th autobiographical monologue. It's about a book I've been working on for the past 5 years entitled Impossible Vacation. The monologue is both about the horrors of writing that monster and the constant interruptions that kept me from completing it.
climb up to that section. I'm on a tooth. I'm on a roll. I'm giggling as I write. I don't know what it is as I get up to write. Renee's sleeping late, naked under the sheets. It's hot. It's hot. I get up to write that particular morning. I'll never forget it. It's so still. There's not a sound. And I sit there, frozen in that silence. And I hear this. What was that? Thunder? Thunder in Los Angeles? Maybe they're shooting a Western down in the canyon, I think. Then all of a sudden, something happens. It's as though they're testing a hydrogen bomb in Los Alamos, and we get the shockwaves coming across the desert. You don't see them, but when it hits the house, the entire house goes... The nation's up making bed and yells, "Fall! It's the earthquake! Run for the goddamn!" Somewhere, Renee has read that during an earthquake, you're supposed to stand in the goddamn. She's got the discipline to do it. My God, I'm trying to get out for the front yard. I'm running through the house in my underwear. The entire house turns to jello under my feet. I get to the front door. Renee's jammed naked in the jam. I can't get through. I'm pushing, I'm shoving. I slip under her and boom, I'm out. And there are all my neighbors on their front lawns in their underwear going, "Hi-ho, good morning. Welcome to California. Welcome aboard. You survived the earthquake. You survived the earthquake." Then the entire neighborhood is buzzing. Everyone's out on their front lawns talking for weeks about, "Where were you? Where were you during the earthquake? Oh, you're kidding. Oh, stop it. Oh, he did? Oh, no. And he thought he caused it? Oh, lover man. Oh, stop it. That's the third one you slept through, Marge. The third one you slept through. You can't insure those little statues. You cannot insure them. You've got to go out and buy the tuna fish and the distilled water. You've got to make the earthquake quick. You've got to look out. Look out for the big one. The big one. The big one. Look out for the big one." Then everyone stopped talking about the earthquake and went back to talking about their film script.
If you really want a treat, go to Big Nick's in New York and have Linda Berry read all the signs, Big Nick.
That was Spalding Gray reading to us from his book, Monster in a Box. This is Dr. Andy of Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. I have a delightful little application on my iPhone. It's called... Poetry. It's from the Poetry Foundation. You might remember that a number of years ago, an heiress gave to Poetry Magazine $100 million. $100 million for poetry. A great number of poets, including Walt Whitman, first book award-winning poet and former KWS DJ, Joshua Clover, came up with ideas of how the $100 million should be spent. I believe a foundation was created. One of the things that the foundation created after being created itself was this application for the iPhone, which when you press the spin button, it spins and spins, and it finally rests upon a theme and then a poem. Well, today the theme is 11 poems on worry and youth. And I've chosen a poem that was originally printed in Poetry Magazine that I've not yet read, called Roy G. Biv. Roy G. Biv is not someone who I went to high school with, but rather it's the mnemonic that we use to remember the colors of a rainbow. Roy G. Biv by Fred Daguiar. D'Aguiar. The shoemaker's wife ran preschool with a fist made not so much of iron, but wire bristles on a wooden brush. She made us recite and learn by rote. Our trick was to mouth words, sound as if we knew what we would one day come to know, what would dawn on us, as sure as a centipede knows what to do with its myriad legs. She made us settle our feet on the mud floor of her daub and wattle hut, and she wielded a cane cut from wood that bit into the palm of the hand and left a burn that resonated up the arm for an age after its smart swing and crisp contact. Worst of all was the shoe cupboard, where the old man stored his wire brushes, a cold, dark, narrow place, replete with brushes hung on nails, covering every square inch, and said to come alive when a child was locked in with them, so that they scrubbed flesh off that child's bones. She said we would end up there if we did not concentrate. So we stilled our feet and spoke the words in the right order, for colors in a rainbow, until the very thing took her place in front of us, arranged in cuneiform, polished, brandishing a window to climb out. Ladies and gentlemen, it is time again to hear the voice of Langston Hughes. No matter how much you hear this and enjoy this funky music that I've got in the background, speaking of music, here is a poem read by Langston Hughes called The Weary Blues. Listen up, people.
Droning a drowsy syncopated tune, rocking back and forth to a mellow croon, I heard a Negro play. Down on Lenox Avenue the other night, by the pale, dull pallor of an old gas light, he did a lazy sway. He did a lazy sway to the tune of those weary blues. With his ebony hands on each ivory key, he made that poor piano moan with melody. Oh, blues. Swaying to and fro on his rickety stool, he played that sad, raggy tune like a musical fool. Sweet blues, coming from a black man's soul. Oh, blues. In a deep song voice with a melancholy tone, I heard that Negro sing, that old piano moan. Ain't got nobody in all this world. Ain't got nobody but myself. I was going to quit my frowning and put my troubles on the shelf. Thump, thump, thump went his foot on the floor. He played a few chords, then he sang some more. I got the weary blues and I can't be satisfied. Got the weary blues and can't be satisfied. I ain't happy no more, and I wish that I had died. Far into the night he crooned that tune. The stars went out and so did the moon. The singer stopped playing and went to bed while the weary blues echoed through his head. He slept like a rock or a man that's dead.
Welcome back, everyone, to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour on KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis. Good to have you here listening to your campus and community radio station. Make sure you stick around after the show for some great music. DJ Tangosaurus Rex is going to be down here. She'll be playing some reggae music, most likely, which I always enjoy hearing. I've got an important public service announcement to share with you, but we need some music for that. The Yolo County Central Landfill has a program that helps reduce waste going into landfills. Residents of the county, including UC Davis students, can now recycle techno trash. VHS and cassette tapes, remember those? CDs, DVDs, and floppy disks. What's a floppy disk, you might be asking? You can recycle all of these things at the Yolo County Central Landfill free of charge. The landfill will also accept TVs, computer monitors, CPUs, and other small electronic items. The landfill is open every day except holidays. For more information about this opportunity, if you still have a phone, you can use it to call 530-666-8856. They also have a website. That's what I'm talking about. It's www.yolocounty.org. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for another short bit by Langston Hughes. We just heard the Weary Blues. This one is called Homesick Blues, here on KDVS.
The railroad bridge is a sad song in the air. The railroad bridge is a sad song in the air. Every time the trains pass, I wants to go somewhere. I went down to the station. My heart was in my mouth. Went down to the station. Heart was in my mouth. Looking for a boxcar to roll me to the south. Homesick blues is a terrible thing to have. The homesick blues is a terrible thing to have. To keep from crying, I opens my mouth and laughs.
This is Dr. Andy with good news. I received an email on my Gmail account, aojones@gmail.com, from Mara Magnuson. She's a poet who I met at the book release party of Lawrence Dinkins' most recent book called Sub-American. That was at Carol's Books in Sacramento. I don't know if you know Carol's Books. It's a wonderful bookstore. Mara and I had met also at a theater in Oak Park, as part of a benefit where I read a couple poems. Anyway, she's written to let me know that at the Crocker Art Museum on July 15th, not June 15th, but July 15th, a mere 5 weeks away, we'll have some of California's most famous poets. In fact, some of America's most famous poets reading at a Squaw Valley Community of Writers poetry benefit. The evening's lineup includes Robert Haas, currently professor of poetry at UC Berkeley, former poet laureate, Brenda Hillman, Kathy Park Hong, Major Jackson, which is a great name, Sharon Olds, and special guest Galway Canal. I used to watch Sharon Olds and Galway Canal read in Boston in the mid-80s. Never before, Mara writes, have so many nationally recognized poets appeared on the same stage at once in Sacramento. And this particular reading will be a benefit to raise money for the Poetry Scholarship Fund at the Community of Writers at Squaw Valley, which is a nonprofit organization. Also, the poets will be donating some books for people to get signed and purchase. So, a great event, the 20th anniversary of the event, and also its Sacramento debut, because all of the previous benefits were held in San Francisco. It's also wonderful to have the luminous mythic verse of Galway Canal in Sacramento. I'm going to be attending this event on July 15th, unless I'm in Denver. And you should, too, if you're a fan of excellent, excellent poetry. It's time for another public service announcement. Speaking of things that are excellent, let's hear now from Ricardo Montalban.
There are many ways to measure success. For the Shriners, it's the nearly 700,000 children with orthopedic and burn problems that they've helped. This is Ricardo Montalban. For over 80 years, the Shriners have provided state-of-the-art medical care to kids all over North America, totally free of charge. There is a Shriners hospital helping kids from this area. If you know a child that the Shriners might be able to help, call 1-800-237-5055. Shriners, giving help and hope to kids for over 80 years.
Just received another email 18 minutes ago from Marie L'Espérance, who's got a really cool name. She's an established poet who will be reading as part of the Valona Deli reading series this coming Sunday afternoon. Marie L'Espérance is a poet who is certainly very talented. She was born in Kobe, Japan. She's a Hapa poet, H-A-P-A, whose first full-length collection, The Darkened Temple, was awarded the 2007 Prairie Schooner Book Prize in Poetry and published by the University of Nebraska Press. Her earlier collection, Begin Here, was awarded a Sarasota Poetry Theater Press Chapbook Prize. And her poems have been nominated twice for a Pushcart Prize. She's a graduate of the Creative Writing Program at New York University, and a recipient of residency fellowships from Hedgebrook and Dorlin Mountain Arts Colony. She lives and writes in San Francisco, and she will be appearing at the Valona Deli Reading Series this coming June 12th, and that's in Crockett, California. Marie Esperance and Armando Garcia Davila. That should be a terrific event. I'm going to see if I can make it to that. This coming Sunday afternoon, Featured Poet starts at 4 o'clock. Well, thanks for sticking around to the end of this particular Poetry and Technology radio show. I'd like to thank none other than Robert Jordan, the author of How They Did It, Billion-Dollar Insights from the Heart of America. It's a fascinating book because, like this show, it features a variety of voices. Unlike this show until today, or maybe a few occasions in the past, this book features only interviews with millionaires. Me, I'm somewhat more populist in making choices of who to have on this show, which means I might even welcome you. If you have something poetic to say, I'd love to hear about it. aojones@gmail.com. You can also Google Andy Jones and Davis. You'll find more about me than even my family wants to know. Stick around for some great music. I'll be back next week for another edition of Dr. Andy's Poetry.